Okay, everybody, welcome to our special Thursday edition machine learning slash pickle seminar. It's my pleasure to introduce Nikita Astrakhantsev, who's I believe a PhD student in Zurich. Are you in Zurich right now, Nikita?
Yes.
Beaming in live across the pond to us. So we're all really excited to hear today's talk, which is on topics close to our heart, spin liquids. Number one, pyrochlor lattices, number two, and Rydberg atom simulators. So welcome, Nikita, and take it away.
Thank you. This must have been the best introduction I ever had for my seminar. So this talk today, which I'll try to keep short-ish, so of about 40 minutes, I will tell you about the interesting physics of the pyrochlor lattice, about the spin liquid states that it hosts. I will talk about our work in Zurich, where we studied the pyrochlor lattice using classical approaches such as variational Monte Carlo and neural quantum states method that you are, of course, all familiar with. And then later, I will also talk about this new Rydberg atom simulator platform and that this pyrochlor lattice can actually be embedded onto this Rydberg atoms platform and what will be the, if we do this, what will be the possible challenges connected to such embedding. So this is the outline of the talk. So first in the introduction, I will speak a little bit about the quantum spin liquid states on the pyrochlor lattice, and I will talk a little bit about this phase diagram. I will unpack it all shortly. Then about our work and unexpected variational results in the pyrochlor lattice using classical approaches. And then at the end about the Rydberg atoms and the relations to the pyrochlor lattice. So let's start with the introduction and first with the notion of quantum spin liquid. So this quantum spin liquid is kind of the lazy definition is that there's a phases of matter not characterized by the symmetry breaking and frustration, geometrical frustration when you cannot satisfy all the bonds on the lattice simultaneously, sort of melts the simple magnetic orders. This is, however, the negative definition. On the other hand, from the positive side, in spin liquid, there must exist the long-range topological order, which cannot be seen by any local measurements, and also fractionalized particles, etc. So these phases, they have interesting physical properties. And one of the first example of the spin liquid state was proposed in 1973 by Anderson by building this resonating valence bond solid ansatz. So basically, when the wave function is given as a sum of all possible dimerizations of the triangle lattice in this particular case. We will come back to this later. So that was in two dimensions. In three dimensions, there are experiments with this. So this is some of the rare earth pyrochlor materials and magnetic susceptibility measurements, for instance, show no signs of order up to very small temperatures. And also the neutron scattering pattern in two dimensions shows this kind of absence of Bragg peaks, but instead this diffusive pattern, which is which hints fractionalization. Why is it so? I mean, if you have a neutron scattering in the lattice and then it creates a magnon of spin 1/2, if this magnon can later fall apart into two spinons with the spin 1/2, then only the full energy and momentum are conserved. And so it gives you some flexibility on this two-dimensional neuron scattering pattern, and the resulting picture is somewhat diffusive, as you see here. So now if we go to the microscopics of this pyrochlor lattice, the lattice is a cubic arrangement of the tetrahedra, which each pair of them shares the local spin. And this corner sharing actually leads to the frustration. So the fully commuting symmetry group includes rotation and inversion that we will also need later. And the Hamiltonian that we consider here consists of these two terms. So those are nearest neighbor and next to nearest neighbor interaction terms with the constants J1 and J2. And each of those terms is an XXZ model with lambda extrapolating from the Ising and Heisenberg limits of the XXZ model. So then we can have a look at the phase diagram in this variable. So on the x-axis, we have this anisotropy, which again, in this corner, we have the Ising model. In this corner on the right, we have the Heisenberg model. And then the J2 over J1, it is the ratio of next to nearest neighbor to nearest neighbor interactions. Now we know if we tune the J2 very high up, then this set stabilizes the magnetic phase called the sublattice ferromagnet, in which each of the sublattices is ordered ferromagnetically. So this is kind of a boring phase. Now we can jump to some other phases. And the first example is this classical spin ice. So when we sit exactly in the easing corner, when we don't have any quantumness, however, we still have some extreme frustration. And in this limit, when we only have nearest neighbor interaction and only easing terms, the Hamiltonian actually simplifies to the sum of individual tetrahedra. And in each of those tetrahedra, we sum all the SZ operators and then we square. So you see, to obtain the ground state of such model, in each of those tetrahedra, you need to have exactly two spins in and two spins out, which gives rise to this thermodynamically degenerate manifold of this so-called spin ice ground state. Yeah, so you see, even at zero temperature, there is the residual entropy, which signals that the number of those spin ice states, it's thermodynamically degenerate. So now, away from this classical spin ice, we can step a little bit to the right, and we can take a look at this U1 quantum spin liquid phase. So essentially what we do is, on top of the spin ice manifold, we switch on some tiny exchange interaction lambda. And what happens is that this lambda, so this exchange term, we can treat it as a perturbation. And then we can wonder, like in the perturbation theory, what process is generated by this perturbation term. So you see, if you essentially act this term once on some spin configuration from the spin ice manifold, you immediately kick this configuration out of the manifold. So sort of the perturbation itself is kind of not allowed. However, some power of this perturbation is allowed. So if you look here on the left-hand side, you see the six tetrahedra, and each of those tetrahedra is happy. Yeah, so here the blue ball sort of signalizes the spin coming up, for instance. Yeah, so now you see each of those tetrahedra have exactly two atoms up and exactly two atoms down. So then if we add this exchange interaction on some bond, we immediately made those two tetrahedra unhappy. And the spin ice manifold is gapped by this two JZZ. So we essentially, we jumped away from the spin ice manifold. However, if we act again, we fixed this tetrahedron here, but instead we made this one unhappy. But actually we can fix everything if we act the third time. And so the resulting allowed perturbation term is so-called this hexagon exchange. So in this three-dimensional particle lattice, you see there are this so-called planar hexagons. And if we have in this hexagon, like up, down, so alternating spin configuration, it can be flipped, and this still keeps you in this spin ice manifold. So the model with, so this Hilbert space and this first order perturbation term can be actually mapped to so-called U1 compact gauge theory. So on each of the sides, we can interpret the spin Z pointing from A to B as the electric field, and the raising and lowering spin operators, we express them as exponentials of the conjugated operators A, which by analogy with electrodynamics, we interpret as the vector potential. And then the Hamiltonian that you have just seen, it's written in this form. So this hexagon exchange term, it simplifies to just cosine of a curl of this electric potential over all hexagons. And here we just added this additional term, which enforces the constraint that electric field is equals plus minus 1/2 on each side. And now it's already almost a textbook Hamiltonian, because if this cosine if the argument of this cosine is close to zero, then we can decompose it into Taylor expansion. And then you see it's essentially a textbook Hamiltonian with electric field and the magnetic field. And so this is the U1 quantum electrodynamics with matter. So first of all, there are quasi-particles of matter, and this is actually gapped fractionalized spin-on. So to see the nature of this gapped fractionalized spin-on, let's take a look at this system of four tetrahedra, and they all are happy, and the energy of this configuration is one. Now let's say, for instance, we are doing some neutron scattering experiment, and we send the neutron to one of these atoms, and we flip the spin from down to up, and we created basically a spin one excitation, and we made those two tetrahedra unhappy. Now, however, if we act with one exchange term in this XZ model, if we act one exchange on this bond, we can move this unhappy tetrahedron from this side to that side at no energy cost. So from this moment on, they kind of are free to move. And so the excitation fractionalized. So initial spin one excitation, it split into the two that can move independently. And also, of course, in this E square plus B square, it's natural that there is a massless photon. However, the coupling constant, the fine structure constant, is not as small as in the normal U1 electrodynamics, but it can, depending on the material, it can vary from up to some very large numbers. And so this is a spin liquid. So it means that there is also a topological order. And in this case, the topological order is the electric flux that goes through some cut of the system. And this flux, it is conserved by the equations of motion, etc. But we are not going too much into the details here, but this U1 spin liquid is very interesting. So this spin liquid is not just some dreams of the theoreticians, because it can also have expected experimental signatures. For instance, this photon should manifest itself in this non-elastic neutron scattering experiment, and we have this is only prediction how the experiment results should look like in terms of the SZ correlator. However, the problem is that this photon has a very small velocity. Therefore, the energy scale of those excitations is very small, that difficult to see in the experiment. And finally, this the existence of this photon should give contribution to the specific heat of this kind. And there, in the Takiwa et al. Experiments, there was a hint of seeing this contribution to the specific heat. However, that could be also attributed to other factors, such as the oscillations of the nuclei. So experimentally, the data is vague at the moment. So now basically we covered all the elements of the phase diagram. So let's just repeat again. In the limit of large J2 over J1, we have this sublattice ferromagnet. In the limit of small lambda, there is the classical spin ice and this U1 quantum spin liquid. And also in the regime of only nearest neighbor interaction and the Heisenberg model, this is actually also an iconic point, which is believed to host the quantum spin liquid in this corner of the phase diagram. So for each of those regimes, there are material compounds that implement small lambda and large lambda. So the pool of all questions that we will somehow address in this the remaining talk would be, so it is U1 quantum spin liquid, it's hard to see experimentally. Can we maybe do it in some other system, maybe in the Rydberg simulator? Yeah, so the nature of this phase in the Heisenberg corner is not understood, so can we understand it? If this is a different phase, then there must be phase transition, so also absolutely no information about basically the whole lambda axis. And for the purpose of predicting the compound's properties, what is the width of this non-magnetic phase? So whatever it is, people know it's not magnetic, this spin liquid. So it can be some valence bond solid, but it's definitely not the spin ordered phase. So what is the width of this phase? And so in here, we get to the second part of my talk, and we're using the classical methods we studied, this lambda equal one case of the Heisenberg model, and we only were changing this J1 over J2 next to nearest neighbor interaction to the nearest neighbor interaction.
Nikita, can I ask questions on the first part?
Because of course, yeah.
On this phase diagram, where are the, you know, the simulation, the quantum Monte Carlo simulations by Sergei Isakov that looked at this XXZ model on the pyrochlore lattice? I'm just trying to understand where they lie here. So they must be, they were XY terms, you know, plus the constraint. Are you familiar with these simulations?
I'm Googling it right now.
Isakov and Yongbae Kim. Isakov's now in, speaking of Google, he works for Google Quantum AI.
But anyway, I met him yesterday, actually.
Really? Small world. Yes. Yeah, so Isakov is a famous quantum Monte Carlo expert who simulated some Hamiltonian. And I think it's just the straight up XXZ model on the Pyragore lattice.
Yeah, I already found it. It's my home, so almost there. Yeah, let me see quickly. All right. So what I see, okay, they have hardcore bosons, but it's fine. You can make spins out of it.
It's a spin. It should be like, yeah, it's a spin 1/2 XXZ. I'm just trying to imagine it here in terms of your anisotropy. So it must have known that it must be on the zero. It's on the X axis somewhere. Or the horizontal axis of the space.
Yeah, it can be in some of this. Well, usually, I mean, the works that are the regime, which is somehow somewhat numerically accessible, is this one.
Yeah, that's what I think, because I believe it was supposed to be the U1 spin liquid that they looked at. So
when you are constrained to this ice manifold, and you work with somewhat like this hexagon flips or something, then there is the regime where you don't have the sign problem. So this U1, you can simulate.
Yep.
But so here we focus on this right axis, where essentially there is a good approach. So this work with this gentleman. So some of them left academia, but most of them are still around. So what could be the method to study the Heisenberg model on the particle lattice in this sort of non-magnetic regime? Yeah, so in one dimension, we know, of course, the ED is good enough and DMRG unbeatable. Well, DMRG you can also expand to sort of three dimensions. However, in three dimensions, we are left without any good approach. So what we try to do is this variational Monte Carlo, a method based on a variational principle that whatever ansatz you can hook up from some parameters, its energy will always be bigger than the energy of the ground state. And the quality of this ansatz is the smallest of smallness of energy. But this for this complicated, highly frustrated paraclore one cannot just take and apply like a neural net or NQS, some deep learning, whatever. We need some ansatz which can capture physics of the parachlor. And as a motivation, we take the idea of Anderson. So here I show it in 2D, but also it can be all expanded to the 3D. So eventually, initially I said that the wave function proposed by Anderson is the sum of all different dimerizations with equal weight. But let's assume that we allow for some alpha, so different weight for this dimer configurations. This actually allows you to express a lot of different types of spin liquids. However, you know, the number of these coefficients grows exponentially, so we need a way to compress the wave function. And for that, people use the so-called non-interacting band Parton model. So you say that, imagine you have, so the wave function is given by the completely field lower band of some non-interacting model. Here is the full sum of the Fermi surface, and then if you expand it, of course, you into the real space, you will see that there will be configurations with, you know, the double occupation and the zero occupation. However, you can deal with those configurations by doing the Gutz-Wheeler projection. And so the variational ansätze that we use in this work are the two types. So first of all, as I said, we do this our resonating valence bond inspired ansatz. And here we work directly with this FIJ, which is somewhat like the density matrix. So we don't work with this the band Hamiltonian of this Parton model directly. We instead work with this FIJ in the exponent. And as a bias control, we also do this neural quantum states method where we project point group symmetry and momentum. Also in this RVB ansatz, you can also project the spin of your wave function, like not only the spin projection, but really the C2 spin if you work in the at the Heisenberg point. And using this RVB inspired ansatz actually gives astonishing energies if you project the spin and point group symmetry and the translational symmetry. At the moment we were working on this manuscript 2 years ago, they actually came out the first work of DMRG for this particle lattice. The DMRG study went only up to 4 to 3 to the cube. 3 to the cube is the linear size of the parachlor lattice, and then to the cube because it's three-dimensional, and 4 here stands for the number of sublattices. So first of all, you see is that wherever the DMRG energy is available, our ansatz is the same or actually better, because here we compare the DMRG at the finite bond dimension. Okay, so what was actually the best energy that they really obtained, not through extrapolation to the infinite bond dimension, but what was the best energy they had. So here it was like maybe a bond dimension 1000, and that's converging very slowly with the bond dimension. So our wave function was better than the DMRG, and then we also could obtain the cluster of 256 spins that nobody could do before. So now equipped with this, so that's kind of was the first result of the work that we were presenting, is that this is the first successful variational study in 3D frustrated magnets. However, and maybe unfortunately or not unfortunately, we were hoping initially that this we will obtain within the neural network and the NQS approach. However, the NQS didn't really perform very well in this three-dimensional lattice, at least for the computational resources that were at hand at the moment. So now equipped with this.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, sure.
So the DMRG geometry is periodic. You know, is it a hypertorus in three dimensions?
Yes.
And yes, so that's for your, so you're also fully periodic?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, for us, periodicity is not a problem. What I understand is that for DMRG, the periodicity is a problem.
Right. That's why I'm not surprised, I guess, that the energy is not great with the DMRG.
Yes, anyway. But they wanted to really address the system that everybody wants. So this parachlor lattice and its energy sort of a question in itself as a benchmark. So what is the energy? So that therefore I think they went for this periodic boundary conditions so that their result will be more cited. Because you know there are a lot of variational studies for this lattice, and if you want to produce a benchmark, you also need to study the same boundary conditions that everybody is doing.
So what about the what'd you call it, the neural quantum? What about the neural network variational ansatz? So could you get anywhere close to these energies?
I don't remember so well the exact values of energy, but they were always somewhat, you know, maybe if RVB has a 1%. You don't know really of the finite system size what is your energy error on a bigger system size. But I mean, even for this point where you sort of know the DMRG benchmark. So when your RVB energy is slightly better than DMRG, the NQS can be, you know, 1-3% wrong to the upside, of course.
All right.
So what was really like a strong NQS method that I liked is this. So the thing is, if you want to study a large system with this deep neural network and you want to project symmetries, what you do is you at least, so the point group you can do somewhat like within this graph neural network, where you basically take some spin configuration, you take several copies of it transformed under the point group, and then you just average the outputs of the neural network, and this way you can project some quantum number that you want. However, if you also add translations to that, you know, the full size of the group explodes and you cannot do it. So what people do, they do convolutional neural networks, at least to account for translational symmetry. But to do this convolutional neural network, you need to see what is happening at the boundary. So you have this, when you do the padding, you need to do a periodic padding so that when you do the convolution, it makes sense. And this periodic padding, etc., I think it's not very efficiently optimized in the SnetCat and in PyTorch respectively. And so that was very painful. In this point, the smallest cluster, which is accessible also within ED, there were like very nice results with unconstrained RBM. So you take the restricted Boltzmann machine with weights not constrained by any symmetry. You train it, and then you project the symmetry at the end. You know, the size of the group is already very large. It has, you know, 8 translations times 48. 48 is the size of the point group. So 8 times 48, okay, already a lot of group elements. So you can, and there the energies were very good, like, you know, almost like 5 digits to the ED result. But then when you go higher, somehow, you know, the neural network is not very computationally efficient. The main problem is that it lacks the fast update. Yeah. So this RVB method, it eventually boils down to the Slater determinant ansatz. And for that, we know how to make a fast update. For neural network, when you flip a spin, you basically need to run all this feedforward thing from top to bottom again. And this I think, what people need to think about how to solve this.
Be interesting to try an autoregressive 3D autoregressive model. Anyway.
Yeah, but in autoregressive, I heard the problem is that it's not very easy to marry it with the symmetries.
There's a debate for another time.
I was just gonna input the way that you described implementing the symmetries is exactly how we do it with RNNs as well. So It doesn't seem like with this averaging over all of the point group translation. Uh-huh. So it doesn't seem like there would be huge overhead. But I guess if you're talking about the translational, then it becomes an issue.
I see. So what you mean is that you can impose it as, you know, sum over projector, but you cannot sort of encode it into the structure of the network. I see. Well, that's interesting. So you see, there are, you know, relevant people on this seminar. I'm happy about it. Okay, so now with this wave function in mind, we can, you know, come to address some physical questions. So the first of all, I mean, the simpler one is, what is the shape of this? So what is the, how much this non-magnetic phase extends on the y-axis? And so basically, so what we do is we look at the magnetic order by constructing this k-dependent magnetic wave operator, which is the sum of SZ operators with the respective Fourier factor, and then we look at the magnetic susceptibility, and then you can measure within this variational Monte Carlo. And then you see immediately the difference between the pattern in the extended brilliant zone at the zero G2 over G1 and at large G2 over G1. So in the case of large G2 over G1, when we are in the magnetic phase, you see that this susceptibility pattern in the extended brilliant zone, it has this pronounced sort of Bragg peaks. However, in the other case, it's sort of smoothened out over the surface of the brilliant zone, the correlations. So if we be a little bit more precise, we can actually also do the extrapolation to the thermodynamic limit. You know, so it extrapolates to zero where it should, and extrapolates to non-zero where it shouldn't. So looks kind of nice. And what we do is we take we take some at finite system size, we create some empirical estimate for the boundary, because we can, on a finite system, we don't really know where the boundary is. So we cook up some estimator for the boundary, and then we extrapolate it to the thermodynamic limit as well. And we see that it extrapolates to some small but still finite number. And this number turns out to be 7 times smaller than some other less controllable studies like PFRG. I mean, okay, they have just different sort of different bias than we do. And also here I show the Monte Carlo studies, like the RVB and neural quantum states, and you see they don't fully contradict each other in terms of the position of the boundary. So these two VMC methods agree on sort of the size of this region. Okay, so now we pinned the position of this phase boundary. Now we can address the second question. Is there symmetry, some sign of symmetry breaking in this quantum spin liquid? And it turns out, that at least within our variational energies that we do, there is a sign of symmetry breaking via the establishment of long-range dimer-dimer order. So to do this, so how to spot this order, we fix one bond in the particle lattice and we measure the dimer correlation between this bond and all other bonds on the lattice. And if the order, the symmetry is not broken, then it's sort of the same constant value over the whole lattice. However, what we see is that this dimer-dimer correlation in the long range distance, they form sort of separate groups. To be a little bit more quantitative, we construct the dimer order parameter by taking the superposition of dimers seeking on all bonds of the lattice, and we weight them with this phase factors Qij. And the example of this phase factors is given in one single unit cell is given on this cartoon on the right hand side. And then you can see that if you play with this xi and omega, you can make this operator auto transform as some specified irreducible representation of your point symmetry group. And by taking xi equals minus one and omega one, you can track the breaking of inversion order, inversion symmetry, and by xi plus one and omega some other root of units, you can track the rotation. And then we measure susceptibility towards this order parameters that we constructed, and we obtain extrapolation to non-zero. So we, you know, when we look, when we know something about this magnetic phase, J2 over J1, because it's just this sublattice for a magnet. So it's a simple sort of almost classical phase. And for this phase, this orders, they extrapolate to exactly how we expect them. So this yellow triangles, so the rotation symmetry is broken in that phase and inversion is not. And so this is exactly what we see in our variational Monte Carlo. However, in this zero case, where we are in the most frustrating point, the susceptibilities extrapolate to the finite numbers. So at least in our variational ansatz, it looks like there is an 18 credence bond solid. Okay, so here we come to the end of the first part of the talk. And the takeaway message is that our classical study yielded quite surprising results. We pinned the position of this phase boundary, turned out to be quite small. And we saw the signatures of spin liquid, signatures of symmetry breaking in this regime, which was believed to be a spin liquid. But I mean, again, so this is only a variational study. So this of course needs to be taken with a grain of salt. And we can, you know, go further by saying, okay, how we can use Rydberg atoms to resolve, maybe to try to resolve this problem in this
question. Okay, just let me make sure I understand it. So you're saying that, that thing you're labeling as quantum spin liquid is actually a valence bond solid. What's the unit cell? I didn't quite, like, how big is the valence bond, the VBS unit cell?
Yeah, so, I mean, we don't see any, like non-zero, so our correlated dimer-dimer correlator, when we try to also add some momentum to this QIG, we see only the decline. So it looks like, I mean, for, again, in our wave function, it looks like it has the unit cell one, but it also depends on what kind of, what size of unit cell you employ in your variation. So,
yeah, that's what I was wondering about, right? So if you scale that, does it change the signature?
Yeah, this I don't know. So I was still young and stupid, and so we only considered the unit cell of you know, the smallest possible, like of four atoms. Mm-hmm. So now I think if I were to repeat the study again, I would try to at least take two by two. So that, I mean, the number of parameters would explode, of course, but I think that is something one would need to repeat.
Interesting.
And maybe even this, you know, maybe you converge to better energies, and maybe this dimer susceptibility would also somehow melt down and disappear. So there is certainly, even in this work, there is some room for improvement. So, I mean, if I had a good, if I had a good master student, for instance, I would, you know, give it to this student, but I don't have any. So anyway, right. So now let's jump to the Rydberg atom story. So this is the thing that everybody is so much interested about at the moment. But I would like to, and with this Rydberg atoms, we would address mostly the questions on this horizontal axis, the lambda. So we have the zero, near, so we don't have this nearest neighbor interaction, next to nearest neighbor interaction anymore. We only have this horizontal axis. And just to repeat, so there is this U1 spin liquid, which is not seen experimentally. This phase on the right-hand side is debated. And if this is not a spin liquid, then there should be some transition. So this lattice, this axis can be studied within the Rydberg atoms. So the Rydberg atoms are, so those are just neutral atoms that are characterized by the large principal number n. And since the distance between the energy levels with the growth of large, with the growth of principal number, it decays as 1 over n to the cube, it leads to actually quite big coherence times proportional to the cubic power of this large principal number. And these atoms are therefore interesting to be used as a computational platform. And if you put two such Rydberg atoms in the same, when this excited electron is in the same orbital parity, then it induces, or in the S or parity, then the dipole-dipole interaction is absent. And the only interaction which is present is so-called van der Waals interaction, which scales as n to the 11, the principal number divided by r to the 6. So this is a very strong interaction, which decays very fast when you take the atoms away. However, if you put together the Rydberg atoms with the different parity, actually there is already the dipole-dipole interaction, which is n to the 4 power divided by r to the cube. Now, if you have a system of these Rydberg atoms, now let's assume they are arranged in some two-dimensional pattern, then the many-body Hamiltonian can be seen in here. So this is like what is the experimental setup in all this Harvard and Paris and Wisconsin experiments. Here, the Rydberg atoms are placed in this two-dimensional pattern, and they are being you know, lit by the laser with the Rabi frequency omega, and this omega is detuned from the exact resonance in this. So single atom, there is the ground state and the Rydberg state when the electron is excited to a harsh, large principal number. And this omega is detuned from the resonance by some small quantity delta, which is called the detuning. And then the full system is sort of like the XXZ, like the transverse field easing model with the long range ZZ interaction. So this omega allows you to jump from ground state to the Rydberg state, which looks somewhat like a transverse magnetic field. This delta is a chemical potential, so it increases the number of atoms in the Rydberg state, but also can be seen as a longitudinal Z field. And then here is the density-density interaction, which is up to some energy shift, is just the long-range SZ-SZ interaction. So the first Rydberg story started with this notion of the Rydberg blockade, if you have the two Rydberg atoms placed close one to another, and then one of them is excited to the Rydberg state, you cannot, the resonance now shifts up to this van der Waals energy, and you cannot, the second atom, you cannot now excite to the Rydberg state, because that would cause a huge energy cost, because they interact so strongly with this van der Waals force n to the 11 divided by r to the 6. So there was like very large progress in the experiment of this Rydberg atoms in the recent years. So in the year 2009, there were observation of the blockade that I have just mentioned. Then a year ago, there was already implementation of the fast CNOT gate using this Rydberg atoms. And four years later, there were already experiments with the 3 and more atoms. Now, a year ago, there were amazing experiments with the implementation of the Z2 Kitaev spin liquid on the Kagome lattice. Of course, you know, measurement of the critical exponent measurement in this quantum easing universality class in 2+1 in when your system undergoes transition from the paramagnet to the antiferromagnet. and also even some iconic algorithms of quantum computing, like quantum approximate optimization algorithm, they were also implemented using this rebrick atoms. So how can we use this platform to study the paracore physics? So first embedding of the paracore lattice into this rebrick atoms, I call it the perturbative embedding. So this is, so to build this embedding, let's consider the case where you don't have any frequency or very small Rabi frequency, which is detuned. And the interaction we will, for now, for the sake of simplicity, we will kind of cut it only on the nearest neighbor, because you remember it was decaying like r to the six. So let's say it only has the nearest neighbor interaction and it has zero otherwise. Then if we tune this detuning up to the 3U, the full Sengupta-Sachdev Hamiltonian simplifies to just the sum over individual tetrahedra, and in each of those tetrahedra there is sum of the Rydberg densities minus two. So to minimize this Hamiltonian, you need in each tetrahedron exactly two atoms in Rydberg state and two atoms in the ground state. So basically, in this way, you can by tuning this delta, the tuning to very high, you can break the Rydberg blockade, and you can allow two Rydberg atoms in the same tetrahedron to be in the Rydberg state. And then the full Hamiltonian is just a simple spinized Hamiltonian, and the Hilbert space is isomorphic to what we know in the spinized case in the paracore. And then when you start to switch on some finite omega, you will see that the first flip in this perturbative order will be exactly the same hexagon flip, which maps from the Rydberg configuration up, down, up, down, up, down, to the down, up, down, up, down, up. So we reproduced the Hilbert space and we reproduced the perturbative term. So we can access this regime of small exchange interaction. But it's not so easy, because there are some but. And this but is that there is next nearest neighbor interaction, this Rydberg atoms, which, you know, it decays, but it's still there. And this nearest neighbor interaction, as you remember from the first part of the talk, it wants to order the system and make it into a ferromagnet. To reduce the effect of this ordering, we need to crank up omega to larger to increase the quantumness. So this quantumness can kill this ordering. However, when you crank up omega, you give rise to higher order terms. So some higher order flips. So this is like a six flip. You will have also like eight flip, 10 flip, all the possible loops you can think about. Yeah, so the question is it really even possible to obtain this exactly U1 quantum spin liquid phase in this Rydberg simulator? And to do so, one needs to do the quantum Monte Carlo. Of course, like you know, you can take this actually from the paper of Roger. You introduce this additional fake time dimension, and then this whole wave function can be written. This partition function is written as the 3+1 dimensional classical partition function with this Hamiltonian here. And also you can then study the finite temperature. So in this method, at least if you manage to, you know, undergo all this, overcome this, all this ergodicity issues and go to small temperature, maybe you can answer this question. Can you, you know, kill ordering with a larger exchange? So that mapping addressed this left corner, so the perturbative mapping. However, we can even do better. And this is based on the recent proposition of Yong Li and also Sun Won Choi from MIT. And the idea is that we will consider the Rydberg system, which will actually have three levels. Yeah, so it will have, the atom can be excited to some S state with a large principal number, and we will interpret it as a spin up state. And but as a spin down state, we will consider admixture of some electron state in the S parity and some other electron states in the P parity. And those are being coupled together by some small microwave frequency. And if you have the states encoded in the, in such a shape, you can, this Hamiltonian, simultaneously have van der Waals and this dipole-dipole interaction, which in this case looks as the just the exchange interaction XX. And then if you move this part to the envelope, you see that this is just the Heisenberg model, the XXZ model with lambda, so with XXZ anisotropy depending on the distance between these Rydberg atoms. So by changing the lattice spacing of this pyrochlore, you can essentially scan the whole lambda axis on this phase diagram that we have just seen, simply by, you know, changing the lattice spacing of your pyrochlore. However, yeah, I mean, the problem is that when you do this admixture, you have anisotropy in your dipole-dipole interaction. So this term actually is not just the C3 over R to the cube, but it also have, you know, a multiplier depending on in which direction this IJ bond points. And the question here will be, can you cook up maybe some complicated admixture here that it has the same exchange values in all of the six directions, like each pyrochlore atom is connected to six nearest neighbors. Can you make it such that this interaction will be the same in all six directions? So this I don't know, but that would be interesting to think about. Yeah, so this brings me to the conclusion of the last part. So the Rydberg atoms can simulate the pyrochlore physics. However, it requires before, you know, doing it into the experiment, this requires, first of all, they need to learn how to make three-dimensional patterns. They don't do it, they cannot do it before, but before that, one needs to do some numerical studies to prepare the ground for such experiments. And then when all these ingredients are there, one could really try to cook up some two-dimensional Rydberg system and to access this U1 spin liquid physics. Right. So that's it. Thank you for your attention. And we have some time maybe for questions.
Thanks, Nikita. I got questions. Anyone else want to go before me? I'll start with an easy one. I'm just kidding. In classical spin ice, there's actually a dipole-dipole interaction. It's 1/R3. And it's known to kill the spin ice state at low enough temperature. Here you're talking about, in the Rydberg case, you have a 1/R6 that you haven't taken into account. You know what I mean? Is there any reason to believe that it won't kind of kill the spin liquid behavior? Are the energy scales such that it's like, I guess you need the energy scale of that 1/R6 to somehow be smaller than like the gap or something. I mean, so any comment about like, what about this van der Waal interaction? How it might affect this?
Yeah, I mean, right. So let me open some appropriate slide. This one, I guess. Yeah, so I mean, what matters is the ratio between nearest neighbor and next to nearest neighbor interaction. So this is what puts you in this phase diagram to somewhere. So it basically, it gives you some horizontal axis. So now let's think, you know, that if we take the nearest neighbor spacing 1, the next to nearest neighbor is √3. And so the ratio of the two will be 1/27. So this seems like a little, but in our variational study, we have seen this is sort of exactly where this threshold lies between. But again, our variational study, maybe it's a bias towards, you know, reducing. So there is some, yeah. So indeed, we don't work directly on this horizontal lattice, but we work somewhere up. But also another thing is there is also next to nearest neighbor interaction, like the J3, and J3 is also positive. However, J3, in terms of this magnetic phase, it acts as -J2. So the J3, it tends towards destroying the ferromagnetic phase, because the J3 acts in the same sublattice. Yeah, and so it's like anti-ferromagnetic interaction in the same sublattice. So the J3 effectively decreases J2. So it puts this, you know, this horizontal axis a bit lower again. So I think with, so essentially the question is, with the large enough exchange, or in this case, with the large enough omega, with the large enough omega, you can move. So omega plays the role of this lambda. Yeah, and so essentially you start like here, you know, when omega is zero, you are definitely in the ordered phase. But then when you move, when you crank up omega, you move to the right, and at some point you must re-enter the spin liquid. So I guess you will not see it immediately from the start because the quantumness is too small. However, you must see it at some point. I mean, that's the hope.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense. Other questions? You mentioned 3D Rydberg systems, but I've seen these, I've seen three-dimensional lattices before. There's no fundamental barrier to them, is there? I mean, I've seen them in the French group, maybe not in the Harvard group.
Yeah, well, so my full knowledge comes from talking to people in QERA, but they might be not on the forefront.
Roger can tell us, but maybe Aquila or whatever is it constrained to 16 by 16 and basically square lattices? That's probably.
I mean, technically, the lattice doesn't really like there's no lattice. Like you can move the atom anywhere you want.
Okay.
But the current machine, like for convenience, we kind of constrain on a square lattice.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I assume probably it's much easier if you have like the second generation machine, like where you can actually tune your lattices, like actually with individual control. Well, the current machine also you can technically also you can specify the position of atoms, but it's still all in 2D. So you probably have to embed 3D in 2D. But if that's the case, then you're limited by the size of blockade.
Right. There are projected pyroglores, I guess. But yeah, I don't know if it would work.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, you cannot, so when you project on the 2D, the system is called the planar pyroglore.
Right.
So it is also called this checkerboard lattice, where in the, like a checkerboard pattern, you have the you know, the bonds, which are on the diagonal. So first, the first problem with this is that to make this diagonal bonds same as, so make J2 equals J1, you will need, to have two Rydberg species. So you will need to have some mediating Rydberg species put in the middle of this plaquette. And then all the interaction goes through this intermediate species. And I think this is the problem, at least with the Ankila or how is it called? Whatever machine of QERA, because they, I think they only have a single species. But anyway, but a bigger problem that is not so easy is that there is also spin ice, and then when you crank up lambda a little bit, it also gives rise to, you know, it's not a hexagon exchange but like a square exchange. However, this immediately turns out into the U1 quantum electrodynamics in confinement. So this fractional spinons, they, you know, confine and form the condensate. And in the language of normal people, this is just a magnetically ordered phase. So, and I checked that in ED some time ago, and it is sort of a common knowledge that the small lambda case here gives rise to just a very boring phase in the planar pyroclore.
Cool.
Yeah, so one needs to think a bit maybe about how to melt that order, maybe by adding some impurities or maybe longer range. Whatever. So it's not, but it's not so straightforward, unfortunately, with just projecting it into 2D.
Got time for one more question.
Can you talk a bit more about like your QMC method?
So I implemented it, but it's not like my method. I think you can better ask Roger. But
this is Marcin Kalinowski's method, right? I think Ejaz knows about this.
Yeah.
One.
Yeah.
So this is from this work.
Mm-hmm. So you're just doing like those local like kind of string updates or like line updates, right?
Now, this is a million question, what kind of updates you need to do. Because when you work close to this easing, close to this spin ice regime, if you have this gap spin ice manifold, and when you're at low temperature and you just flip a single spin or a line of spins, you create a lot of energy. So you need to come up with something more clever, like hexagon flips.
Okay.
Hexagon flips in the tube, like over all time dimensions. Just this is what I was trying at some point, but at the moment this is sort of on hold.
Okay.
So if you want to jump in and maybe think a little bit with me, you're more than welcome.
Okay. Cool. Thanks.
Very cool. Anybody else? Okay, if not, let's thank Nikita again. Mm-hmm.